Chechen Blues by Alexander Prokhanov. Translated by Anna Ivanova. Chapter 1. It was winter, with a pale sun and barely noticeable sparkle of frost. Under this chilly illumination, there were protrusions and figures of armor, turrets of tanks with long, black cannons, APCs, columns of honed infantry war machines, cargo vans, and Kungs, with lattice dishes of antenna arrays, pins, crosshairs, and masts, canvas tents spewing smoke from iron pipes, artillery tractors, and ambulances with stretchers. In its midst, a black pothole in the road that was hastily repaired caused a tank to break down and slip, unable to escape. And behind this road was a brown Chechen steppe with rusty hills and confused, withered weeds, a reddish village with brick houses and a spindle-shaped prickly mosque. Beyond this, in the distant fog, was a white-pink city with smoke, neighborhoods, indistinct flickers, waving steam, and mysterious, indistinct life. These sights were separated from Kudryavtsev's eyes by a thick, icy blue air, punctuated with a rare flight of sparkling, multicolored snowflakes. Captain Kudryavtsev, the company commander, was looking at Grozny, where the brigade was aiming. The city seemed like an illusion, ready to disappear that day on New Year's Eve. He was watching the flying sparks in the distance. The soles of his boots rested on dry, frozen ground, under which a liquid, unhardened mud stirred. The combination of winter light through a blurred, silvery cloud and flashing, colored snowflakes had suddenly shaken him, as if an invisible particle had flown in and hit his temple. It punched a tiny hole like a needle prick, and he flew into another space and time through this puncture. Their house was surrounded by a fence. There was frozen mud by the porch and a goose that acted like it was important and sleek. It was standing on its pink leg with its neck pulled in and its orange beak resting on its chest. A Christmas tree could be seen through the window. Anyone who saw it would feel a nostalgic sadness, a feeling that the last moments of the year were disappearing, and a premonition of something huge awaiting them, as if it were a flight of sparkling snowflakes. It lasted for just a second, and then he came back to reality. He was standing on the Chechen hills among tanks, antennas, and tents. The oil truck was driving slowly out of the muddy clay that covered the road. It was roaring loudly and sliding in the muddy tracks. A messenger came up running, splashing through the puddles with his soiled boots. From afar, he put his hand to his spotted cap for a salute and loudly cried out, "Comrade, Captain, you must go to the brigade commander. It's urgent." He thought of the goose with the orange beak and the Christmas tree decorated with ornaments as he passed through an infantry square made up of armored personnel carriers and tanks, half sunk in the mud. He went around the communication vehicles with squealing and screeching radios and the command tent covered with a camouflage net. He approached the Kung where the brigade commander lived. In front of the Kung, the chief of staff, the chief of artillery, a deputy for the rear, the chief of intelligence, and a special officer had already gathered. The whole great Kural. Kudryavtsev thought in awe, stopping a little further away so as not to mingle with the senior officers. "And why me, I wonder?" The officers impatiently rocked back and forth while glancing at the iron doors from where the brigade commander was expected to appear. The chief of staff was a thin man with a dull, yellowish face. He also had a duck nose and painful, anxiously shifting eyes. He was feverishly coughing into his bony fist.
"Tell me the situation first. Give me the location of the enemy. Give me a line to the artillery, and only then push me into the city. We've been here for a week. Have you been there, Scout? I'm asking you, can you show me the location of the strongholds?"
"Never mind where the strongholds are located,"
the chief of intelligence dismissed him.
"The trolley buses are running, and the shops are open. Let's go in, look around, and I'll even take you out to a restaurant."
"They'll take you to a restaurant with a grenade launcher to the balls," snapped the chief of staff, and immediately started to hoarsely cough into his unwashed fist.
Everyone watched how painfully his shoulder blades moved on his bent back. The chief of staff was a smart and meticulous person. He was annoyed with the eternal ailments, disorder, lack of equipment and personnel, worn-out engines, lack of shells, confusion, and haste in which this host convened. The engines were somehow loaded onto the transport. They were dragging them for a week across the central Russian plains and landed them in the damp winter foothills, moving straight ahead, bypassing roads and highways. It was at dusk, on the very first encounter with the enemy from the neighboring hills, that the Grad rocket launchers struck the column. It destroyed a truck and overturned two APCs. Red tracers flew thickly in the darkness. White dotted lines of machine guns were crossing and flashing. A truck was burning with thick smoke, and the company commander, Kudryavtsev, came under fire for the first time. He stood there, watching, perplexed at the chaotic dance of the multicolored lights that filled the sky. "Does anyone know why the brigade commander called us? Maybe to drink in honor of his new star?" The special officer bantered as he snapped his finger on his neck, as if he had already seen a soldier in a white apron carrying fresh pastries and a pot of potatoes with green, poisonous-colored tomatoes, ready to be served on the table, accompanied by their favorite bottle of booze. "Lucky commander, he achieved colonel on New Year's Eve. That's what it means to be friends with Santa Claus." Everybody started laughing. The special officer's joke hinted at the commander's connections in Moscow, and the joker himself looked like the town drunk who knew where to drink. The brigade was like a big village, where instead of houses and buildings, there were APCs and tanks lined up in formation. Any incident or rumor traveled from car to car, from crew to crew, as quickly as rumors spread within a village. The order to bestow the rank of colonel had not yet come through officially, but only through word of mouth, as it became common knowledge to every ensign and conscripted soldier, which excited them and made them happy. It seemed as if it touched them personally and promised good changes. The officers were happy, but also envious, because they knew that with the brigade commander's new rank, the way to Moscow was open to him, toward the elegant, sugar-colored building of the General Staff Military Academy, away from the Chechen fields, away from the frosty cars in the city square and the foggy, dirty white, and hostile city.
"The commander made it clear that in the evening we are to wash the star," said the deputy from the rear. He was a plump, loose major whose uniform sat awkwardly, as if damp, whose cheeks turned a deep red crimson when in stressful situations.
"I got a calf for the occasion. Let's taste some fresh veal."
"Whose is it? Dolievsky's?"
asked the special officer, wafting at the air, as if hoping to catch the smell of hot meat aromatizing around the cold armor and exhaust of the tank.
"Where, dare I ask, did you get it?"
"He surrendered himself as a prisoner of war."
The deputy at the rear chuckled and looked over at the towers and cannons in the distant rusty hills, where the village was turning red in the evening sunlight frost, with a mosque in plain view.
"He voluntarily came over to our side."
Kudryavtsev stood at a distance, listening to the officers joking. He was uncomfortable and anxious in the winter wind, which carried away the bluish exhaust of the tank. Under the low sky was the pointed mosque, and the white sun peeked through the camouflage net. There were many prints of soldiers' boots in the viscous, frost-stuck mud. Everything was so fragile, but it all gets lost in time. It was the last day of the year, and it was already ending. The metal door of the Kung opened with a screech, and the brigade commander appeared. He knew that they were waiting for him. He had heard some of the conversations. His pink, shaven face displayed health and freshness. It was not affected by the difficult and dangerous crossings along the muddy Chechen roads under the sullen looks of the residents who watched of the movement of the armored columns. His black, cheeky mustache over his luscious lips was trimmed, and in his dark, shiny eyes, mocking and imperious, he was anticipating the officer's holiday at the New Year's celebration. His dense body, deftly and well drawn into a clean, ironed shape, enjoyed the opportunity to move as he balanced on the wobbly steps of the Kung. In the frosty wind, it smelled of expensive cologne from his wet, smoothly combed hair, from his vest that turned blue at the unbuttoned collar, and from his washed hands and pink nails. An oval mirror shined through the open door.
in the illuminated space of the Kung, along with a small, green, faux Christmas tree with glass ornaments.
"Hello, comrade officers," the brigade commander said cheerfully, benevolently, and contentedly looking around at his companions who were waiting for him. They were a close-knit circle of people who knew and respected each other, among whom he sat at the head of the table.
"Allow me to congratulate Comrade Lieutenant Colonel,"
the chief of artillery cheerfully and loudly exclaimed, capturing the mood of the commander and playing along with him.
"What should I congratulate you with?"
The commander raised a thick eyebrow, feigning surprise.
"It seems that half a day is left before the new year."
"Congratulations on your promotion to colonel,"
the chief of artillery reported loudly, as if conducting the ceremony himself.
"And if you're ready, Comrade Brigade Commander, we are ready to toast your star."
"What do you mean? Where did you hear that? There is no such promotion."
The brigade commander was dismissing superstitiously, pretending to be angry, while shaking his beautifully combed head. But the smile that ran over his ruddy lips could not hide the fact that he already knew about his promotion. He was happy and thankful to the officers who congratulated him on the good news.
"I'll give you the star, Comrade Brigade Commander," said the special officer, squinting his eyes at his own field shoulder strap with the green star for the rank of major. "Let's drink a toast, and the army surplus will arrive and join us. Larissa will open her tent, where you can buy a star from her and give it to me."
Everyone smiled and winked faintly. Of course, they did not believe that the special officer did not already have a couple of new stars to pin on the commander. Before going on the campaign while waiting on their orders, the special officer took care and bought them in town. In the military shop, behind the counter, among the piled copper buttons, gilded cockades, chevrons, field and ceremonial shoulder straps, stood the regal, magnificent, and lazy saleswoman Larissa with wet, shimmering eyes, a white, open neck, and fragrant hair that fell to her shoulders. She was constantly smiling at something, absent-mindedly listening to customers. Everyone knew that she was not indifferent to the brigade commander. Now, lagging behind the brigade, she moved with the rear in the van of the military surplus. The brigade commander hung an oval mirror in his kung, decorated a Christmas tree, trimmed his mustache, and sprayed himself with cologne, expecting from hour to hour the appearance of the long-awaited rear column.
"As you all know, we have deployed a task force to the district," said the brigade commander, becoming serious. "The general is recalling us to his location. I believe there will be a brigade review. Each of you, I am sure, will be able to competently answer the deputy commander's questions. Do not overestimate our capabilities, and do not try to show off. But do not underestimate, and do not groan and cry. Do I make myself clear, Scout?"
"Yes, sir, Comrade Colonel."
The scout leaped to attention with his dashing hussar mustache. His bulging blue eyes laughed. Everyone appreciated this appeal to the brigade commander as an accomplished colonel. The brigade commander did not correct him. An expression of undisguised pleasure arose and lasted for a moment on his cheerful face.
"Comrade Brigade Commander, did you call me?" Kudryavtsev reminded the commander that he was there, standing aside, not mingling with senior officers invited to report to the general.
"You will come with us,"
the brigade commander said sternly.
"We will show him your company as being the most effective in terms of combat and political training."
He said the last words with irritation, making it clear that he was talking about the most recent incident. Two warrant officers, drunk, opened fire from their grad and damaged a roof in the Chechen village, causing some indignant old men from the village to protest the brigade commander.
"And in the evening we'll have a festive dinner. Deputy for the rear, get 4 bottles from the emergency rations."
He jumped off the steps of the Kung. The officers parted, letting him in, and followed their commander. Kudryavtsev, closing the procession, saw the polished boots of the brigade commander shine and the frozen, viscous mud crumble under them. The headquarters tent, into which the officers entered, was intensely heated. The iron stove crackled with wood, and the crimson coals could be seen. Lamps hung from the ceiling under tin visors. A huge map of Grozny lay on the floor under a blinding light. Around it, trying not to step on the blocks, neighborhoods, and streets, the officer stood. The large map showed neighboring units scattered across the steep, from consolidated regiments to artillery batteries
and Marine Corps brigades. They looked enchanted at the city, which had arrows dismembering it. The general walked on the map, advancing on crisp paper with leather boots. He was clean-shaven, with a big elbow and stubbornly knitted eyebrows. Heavy eyes glanced sternly at the officers. The general was in striped pants that were tucked into his socks. He wore leather slippers that were pointed upwards and a red brace over his uniform as he walked across the map's urban landscape, which gave him resemblance to General Yermolov, who, as Kudryavtsev read about, also walked in slippers on a map spread like a carpet in a camping tent. Kudryavtsev was amazed at the coincidence, and then he guessed that the general deliberately wanted to be like Yermolov, and he wanted the audience to discover the similarity.
"I gathered you here to bring orders from the Minister of Defense. The orders arrived at the task force last night. It is not open for discussion, and we will do our best to immediately fulfill it."
He looked around at the officers with heavy eyes, peering out from under their bulging foreheads, and Kudryavtsev could not tell whether these expressions were connected to their new orders or with the irony in the general's resemblance to Yermolov. Kudryavtsev noticed the brigade commander of the Marine Corps also perceived the subtle irony. He grinned and said something quickly to his neighbor, an officer in a black Marine uniform.
"The orders from the Minister of Defense read as follows. Parts of the brigade stationed within the vicinity of Grozny must enter the city, move toward the administrative center, from the presidential palace to the post office, to the train station, to the main government administrative buildings. Stand in blocks along the main street and, indicating presence, take up defensive positions. Do not engage the enemy. We will give them the opportunity to leave the city in groups along the abandoned corridors. Enemies that leave the city will become targets for our aviation and artillery and will be defeated and scattered outside the residential areas of the densely populated city, which is fraught with great destruction and casualties among the civilian population. Due to being unprepared and small in number, the enemy cannot offer serious resistance to the regular army. The regiments and brigades are scheduled to perform today at 1600 hours. I invite everyone to listen to the plan for entering the city that was developed by the task force." It became so quiet that one could distinctly hear the humming vibration of the crimson stove and the crunch of the paper map on which the general's pointed shoes stepped over. The officers were silent, assimilating what they heard. The general was also silent, giving some time for surprise, disagreement, misunderstanding, and murmurings to slowly and steadily turn into readiness for carrying out the military order.
"Now the details about the routes, the individual task assigned to each military unit, and the rules of engagement."
The general broke the silence, believing that the order was imprinted under the skullcaps of the commanders, where it fit tightly and meaningfully behind their foreheads, at the bottom of their eyeballs. The order was also imprinted on the bridges of their noses and in dark wrinkles.
"Our orders are as follows."
His pointing stick looked like a billiard cue and was inlaid with bone and pearl pieces. Copper rings were placed onto the mahogany along its entire length. He used the pointing stick like a cue, as if preparing to break the pyramid of pool balls. And one of these balls represented Kudryavtsev's company, as well as his life.
"There are three routes offered: the Motorized Rifle Brigade, another consolidated regiment, and separately, the Marine Corps Brigade. The routes allow all brigades to reach their destinations at the same time at 2200 hours and take up defensive positions."
Kudryavtsev watched the general's pointer move around the map. He tried to learn the plan by heart. He tried to remember the streets along which the armored vehicles and tanks would pass, the names of squares and parks where ambushes and mine explosions were possible, crossroads from which shelling and raids were possible. He knew his company would be in the vanguard. His company was supposed to be the first to go to the station square, put up obstacles in front of the train stations and warehouses, and wait for the Marines to come out on the flank along the railroad tracks. The arc will close, and like a compressed spring, the armed groups of Chechens will begin to retreat. The company commander stood up to his waist in the hatch of the tank and looked at the stucco building of the station and the platform of the shiny track which reflected the night's light. He saw the track and the building of the station as if looking at a color photograph, even though he had never seen or been there before. The distant city dragged him into its gravity,
with excitement and a sweet anxiety generating in his soul. But there were also premonitions and fears that were akin to knowledge. Flexible steel columns deployed turret machine guns and cannons on two sides into a sort of herringbone, led ready to attack the lighted windows, facades, and night lamps in lilac rings. This sweet anxiety atoned for all hardships and tribulations and made his military profession attractive and desirable.
Unit commanders and chiefs of staff will receive city maps with route markings. You will have time to explain and brief these orders to the commanders of the units,
the general explained. He threw his pointer into the air and deftly caught it by the thick end, as experienced billiard players do before bending down and placing their spread fingers on the green cloth of the billiard table.
I must add that tomorrow is the Minister of Defense's birthday. Accomplishing this task he has assigned us will be the best birthday present. And he, I know.
The general smiled, showing his strong, yellowish teeth that made him look like an elderly yard dog.
We'll make sure there is proper compensation and rewards. Any questions?
The general twisted his bobbed head impatiently, looking at the commanders, artillerymen, scouts, signalmen, and air gunners. Not expecting inappropriate and ridiculous questions, he was preparing to release them from the heated tent out into the damp space where tanks and combat vehicles hunched over.
Questions?
He repeated, glancing at the table lined with telephones and walkie-talkies, near which the signalman was on duty. Kudryavtsev observed the officers and saw how differently they took the minister's order. Some, and among them the brigade commander of the Marines, did not discuss the order. Concerned and stern, they were already thinking about how to fulfill it. The officers were among the armored columns, assigning the crews to their vehicles and making sure that nobody was lagging behind. The vehicles entered the filling stations, along with the ammunition trucks and the ambulances. Others, and among them Kudryavtsev's commander, were upset and annoyed and complained about the disrupted New Year's dinner, silently hating the general and the Minister of Defense, who decided to drag troops into the city on New Year's Eve, dooming them to a sad night in iron cars, making it impossible to sit by the hot stoves in a smoky kung for a roast, for a bottle, for anecdotes and songs with a guitar. Still others, who were younger, such as the Chief of Intelligence, whipping in different directions with his gallant golden mustache, rejoiced at the unexpected throw, the opportunity to distinguish themselves, to be in full view of their superiors, to earn awards and titles. A few, such as the Chief of Staff, were tormented by disagreement, but did not dare express it to the general. They were ready to remain silent and to carry their disagreement with them. The Chief of Staff looked at the brigade commander and tried to catch his eye. With a suffering and dissenting look, he urged the brigade commander to speak on behalf of the brigade officers, but the brigade commander was silent.
"Can I ask a question, Comrade General?"
The Chief of Staff turned to the general with a thin yellow face, plagued by malaise and insomnia.
"Speak,"
the general said with displeasure, annoyed at the delay.
"I have several remarks on the outlined plan of the operation."
The Chief of Staff greedily gulped the hot, smoke-filled air, as if preparing to rush into fluid-like, airless depths, gathering all his remaining energy for a fatal leap.
"I must report that there is not enough intel about the enemy at the brigade headquarters, their numbers, weapons, places of deployment, methods of ambush. The team, due to lack of time, was deprived of the opportunity to carry out reconnaissance on their own, but the task force did not receive information from our intelligence agents."
The general rolled his eyes, swelling with anger and surprise. His feet and woolen socks and shoes were in a stable position, as if he was preparing to strike a boxing punch into the ugly, duck-nosed face of the Chief of Staff, who no longer wanted to notice the danger.
"It seems to me that our armored columns advanced through the city blocks without any support from infantry, and without first setting up roadblocks on the routes, contradicts the classic tactics of combat in urban areas. In the academics, we were taught to use the experience of recent wars. There is danger in exposing military hardware and personnel under attacks of grenade launchers and snipers."
The officers were ready to disperse, to take with them an unexpected plan of operation full of absurdities and contradictions, in order to proceed at their own peril and risk, filling in the gaps with their own experience, with the skills and diligence of their soldiers, and the hope of military success. The officers whispered, trampled underfoot, and shook their heads,
supporting the brave chief of staff who, like some sort of suicidal person, objected to the minister's order.
In addition, the backlog of rear units and the lack of fuel and ammunition can lead to complications during the fighting. Insufficient subunits, incoordination of consolidated regiments, poor training of personnel, who are mostly first-year soldiers, can lead to significant casualties in such difficult urban battlefields.
The general blushed, as if a red lantern had been pointed at him. His cheeks were becoming crimson, like a red-hot stove wall. He felt the mood of the officers, who had grown bolder after the speech of the chief of staff. They were ready to bombard the general with a barrage of questions, remarks, and doubts. Blushing, he was gripping his cue with his white bone fist.
"Therefore,"
the chief of staff concluded his speech, looking not just into the general's face, but also at his shoes, which were trampling on the map of the city.
"It seems appropriate to postpone the operation into the city for a week, conduct intensive reconnaissance along traffic routes, draw up detailed schematic maps showing us each checkpoint's location, every street name and every building number, bind artillery targets at every intersection and obstructions that the enemy can use as strong points, use the delay time for accelerating coordination, training the personnel of the subunits. That's all, Comrade General."
He stopped talking, feeling amazement at his courage. For a moment, a void formed around him, like around a stone that had fallen into the water. In a second, the irritability and impatience of the officers should have poured into this awkward silence, and anticipating them, the general stepped toward the chief of staff, crunching the map of the city, stepping on the presidential palace, on the central street, on the station building under purple winter lanterns, and on the black and white steel track reflecting lights.
"Who are you to question the order of the Minister of Defense?"
The general raised his voice, in almost a shout, giving his voice a deliberate scream and wheeze.
"You talk like a self-taught soldier who was allowed to participate in regimental exercises. Did you know that the plan was developed in the main operations directorate using all the data from space and from all the intelligence at our disposal? It is fully agreed upon with the political leaders of the country. It had been finalized at the headquarters of the district. It was brought to you after dozens of the best staff officers worked on it."
The general established himself in his superiority. He saw the chief of staff cringing, pressing his narrow head into his shoulders. Pale, white spots appeared on his yellowish, haggard face.
"The operation is bloodless and purely demonstrative," the general continued. "It will not require large-scale street battles like in Berlin in 1945. According to operational data, the enemy is already leaving the city, seeping out of it in small groups. You just need to push, make some noise, rattle the cage, and he will retreat. Chechens are all bandits and thieves who are only capable of robbing trains and store counters. They'll scatter at the sight of such a show of force. Therefore, I repeat, the plan assumes organization in solid columns and placement in open areas of the city."
The general, large, strong, crimson, felt his moral and physical superiority over the stunted and sickly chief of staff. He bent him over and continued to bend and break him, and along with him, the silent, retreating officers who gave over the unlucky comrade to the general's reprisal. Kudryavtsev alone felt their torment, cowardice, and inability to support. The bridge commander averted his eyes. He did not want them to meet with the general's, the chief of staff's, or anyone else's who was looking for a commanding gaze.
"Maybe you're just afraid," the general scoffed. "Maybe you just don't want to tear your ass off the warm stove. Maybe you prefer to get spoiled on New Year's Eve. In recent years, there are too many officers who are accustomed to the rear's chow and are afraid of combat like a devil running away from incense. If you're a coward, write a report and I will dismiss you from the operation. Your comrades will go without you, and then we will deal with you personally."
Kudryavtsev saw how the chief of staff was insulted, how the cowardly brigade commander was not saying a word, how the suppressed officers slumped. He felt shame and disgust for the general, and contempt for the brigade commander. He was ready to speak from behind the officers and throw furious words in the face of the offender, but the phone rang out loudly, with a special ringing, and the signalman hastily grabbed the receiver and reported.
"The first is in touch, Comrade General."
The general's expression changed from an imperious, merciless one into another, helpful and respectful. He gripped the phone tightly and said,
"I can hear you, Comrade Minister."
"That's right.
Comrade Minister, the order has been given to the troops.
Comrade Minister, the attitude is fighting, cheerful.
Comrade Minister, and where else should they go?
Just forward.
Happy birthday and a happy new year. We will be glad to see you in Grozny, and as they say, clink glasses with you in the presidential palace. Thank you. Thank you for everything.
Everything will be done, Comrade Minister.
Kudryavtsev heard the conversation. He was imagining Moscow's white marble ministry building, a huge office with portraits of czars and generals and huge globes, in front of several colored telephones where a festive, energetic minister, with the cheerful eyes of a paratrooper, stood. The minister puts a gold star onto his shoulder strap and sends greetings to the Chechen hills and foothills. The general hung up the telephone with a loud slam. For another moment, he kept a solemn expression on his weathered, crimson face.
The meeting is over, comrade officers. Prepare the troops for the march. At midnight, I will personally arrive to the city to check on the execution of our orders and wish the commanders and personnel a happy new year.
He turned away and went into the depths of the tent, crossing the crisp map. The officers left, silently and gloomily dispersing. Kudryavtsev saw how the brigade commander was nervously fiddling his trimmed mustache, like a stooped old man stepping toward the chief of staff. He felt embarrassment for his commanders. He lagged behind them in order to not hear the scouts' inappropriate, awkward jokes.